at The Letters, Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson Smith.
The Jimenez pitch, fly ball deep left field. Yes, sir, the Blue Jays are going to Texas. Edwin Encarnacion has won it for the Blue Jays 5-2 with a dramatic 11th inning home run into the 200 level here as he's mobbed by his teammates and a sea of blue down on the field.
It's At The Letters for Wednesday, December 21st on Sportsnet.ca and on iTunes. My name is Arden Zwelling. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host Ben Nicholson-Smith, who's wearing a suit today. Ben, what's going on?
Not too much.
Had to let the people know. Very happy as well to be joined in studio by two other members of the Sportsnet baseball team. We have Mike Wilner from the Sportsnet 590, the fan radio broadcasts. What's going on, Mike?
Everything is swell.
Mike's getting
ready for the big vacation trip and in a chair that's way smaller than all the other chairs in this place.
You are at a much different level than us. You also have new glasses.
Yes.
And you're uncertain about them.
Well, just like the last pair of glasses I had, I'm not in love with them. But at least I can read now. And I think that's probably more important. And they are Sportsnet approved.
What happened to the last pair of glasses?
I needed new glasses.
Oh, so now that's your backup.
Yeah.
Now they become the second string glasses.
But as you know, as you guys will find out in 15 or 20 years, I will need reading glasses with the old glasses. So now with these glasses, I don't.
It's never going to happen. I'm planning on just not getting old. It's just never going to happen.
It's not a bad plan.
It's never going to
happen. Hasn't worked for anybody yet.
I'm not doing it. I'm opting out.
Good luck with that.
Opting out. And we also have sportsnet.ca's Shai Davidi with us as well. Shai, what is going on?
Not much. I'm riveted by your opt-out plan. I'd like to get the details.
There's only one way to opt out.
Yeah, it's not a good resolution. Not one that you'd want.
There's some good aspects to it. I don't know. I could see the benefits. It's a dark start to the pod.
Very dark.
But it's good to have everybody here. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, all that stuff to everybody. You know, best of the season. We're going to look back. This is a good time of year to reflect. We're going to look back on the season that was for the Toronto Blue Jays. We'll look forward briefly, but we're mostly going to look back and talk about, you know, just what happened this year. So we'll begin with what do we feel was the defining moment of the 2016 Blue Jays season? I'll start to my left with Ben.
I debated picking the Jose Bautista interview where he said he wasn't giving a hometown discount because that is memorable.
Yeah,
and in a lot of ways it did play out over the course of the season, but I'm just going to keep it very simple and just say the Encarnacion home run to walk off over the Orioles in the wild card game. I mean, that's the simplest answer. I don't know if you guys have different takes, but that was a big moment.
For me, there are a couple of ways you can go because you're asking about the defining moment. If it was biggest or most memorable, absolutely it would be that Edwin one, right? But the defining moment could be the meeting in Houston where they decided that Aaron Sanchez wasn't going to the bullpen.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I remember very vividly walking back to the hotel from Fenway Friday night, that last weekend in Boston after the Blue Jays had lost, and thinking, if I write a column tonight, it's going to be, you know what? Maybe they're just not good enough. Maybe this team is just not good enough to make the playoffs. And we got to, you know, that's the way it works sometimes. It seemed like it was a manifest destiny from the start of the season that the Jays were going to do well, make the playoffs, everything would be great. Maybe they're just not good enough. But then on Saturday, then maybe you have that defining moment. That Ezekiel Carrera little poke nothing single over third base with a runner at third and a 2-2 tie in the top of the ninth. Might have been the eighth, but I think it was the ninth. And that kind of got the ball rolling. It started what would be a 6-game win streak that included that Edwin home run, which for sure is the biggest moment. But maybe that's it.
Yeah, I agree to some degree with what both you guys say. Because, I mean, Edwin Encarnacion's home run is an iconic moment for the franchise. Like,
yeah,
absolutely like a top five moment. And it's really hard to argue against that. But if you're going to pick maybe a defining moment, you know, the Carrera single is good. But I think about the Troy Tulowitzki RBI single on the Sunday in the ninth inning, the go-ahead single off Brad Ziegler.
Yep.
And in a lot of ways, that sort of encapsulated so much about this Blue Jays team, right? It's like, nothing came easy. Everything was a struggle. They had a scratch and claw for every little thing. And this supposedly mighty offense so adept at hitting the home runs, has to get this dinky little single just barely over the infield to scratch out the one run they need to save their season and extend things. And that, in a lot of ways, to me, carried a lot of definition for the way things went. And you can almost argue that, you know, similarly, the way Roberto Osuna closed things out in the bottom of the ninth there, where, you know, a couple of guys got on, there was a lot of tension, were they going to be able to finish it or not? You know, that is a lot of the Blue Jays narrative in 2016 as well. But, you know, the Encarnacion home run, without a doubt, is the thing that you will take with you from this season. And anyone who saw it is going to remember it for the rest of their lives.
Osuna pitched he threw 100 pitches that weekend. He got 6 outs, I believe, in each of the last 2 games, as there was just no bullpen to speak of. So that Tulo hit, Dustin Pedroia almost had it.
Right.
It was right there. And it wasn't a single by Carrera. It was a sac fly.
Was it?
It was against Craig Kimbrell comes on, Michael Saunders walks, Kevin Pillar bunts him over. There's a wild pitch.
Did Pompey pinch run in there?
Yes. Yeah. Pompey pinch ran for Saunders.
I remember. And there's a wild pitch. I remember pitch, thinking and all they need is a sac fly, but I thought he hit a single. But okay, it was a sac fly. It's a sac fly.
He got it deep into the left field corner, right?
Yes, exactly. So, and
maybe it's the punch in the face too that leads to the circle, right? That leads to the circle of Rougned Odor throwing the ball away in extra innings to clinch that for the series for the Jays. That has a lot. That was a pretty big moment too.
Definitely, as far as discussion generated, I mean, that was a huge moment. Or it was early in the season. It didn't
still
have the same.
Still, the most downloaded Blue Jays talk of the year. Was that day,
right? I like that the Edwin one obviously sticks out, and that's because, and I think it was because things have gone so poorly for the Blue Jays to the point where, like you were saying, Friday night you were going to write a column, maybe it's not going to happen. I remember thinking several times they're going to blow this. Yeah. This is happening. This is really falling apart before our eyes, and they just it's not. This isn't a team that cruised into the playoffs. It's a team that drunkenly stumbled into the playoffs. And needed that. But that Edwin Encarnacion home run was the first time I think when things started going right for the Blue Jays. They didn't have to face Zach Britton. Ubaldo came in and he's throwing BP. That was the first time in a while, I think, that the Blue Jays caught a break there.
Yeah, and it was the first time, I think, for a lot of fans where it actually felt oh, wait a second, the Blue Jays aren't falling apart. They actually can do something with this season. And at that point, it was open to them as much as it was to the Cubs or anyone else. I mean, they were one of the 8 teams at that very moment. And I think that was the first time people had actually felt optimistic in the better part of a month.
It really felt that weekend in Boston, it was, once they had kind of survived that, it was all right, we really are through the worst of it. And all the baggage that accumulated over that month of September, think about the way they started that Red Sox series at home at the beginning of the month and how dismal that was, getting blown out on the Friday, the team meeting on the Saturday, they scratched one out on the Saturday, but then struggle again on the Sunday, and then they lost to 2 or 3 to the Rays, I think was immediately afterwards.
Yep.
So there was so much baggage that accumulated from that point. And the bile that can gather when you've got a division in your grasp and all of a sudden you're scratching and clawing for a wild card, which is, a one game lottery coin flip that nobody wants. And just once we were through that, once they had pulled out those 2 games into the Red Sox, it was like a switch had turned.
It really was, except then you remember that they scored 2 runs in the first 10 innings of the wild card game. They were still having such a hard time scoring. But then I think the switch flipped when Edwin hit the homer, because then you go to Texas and you blow them out twice and score 15 runs, 17 runs in the first 2 games or whatever it was. Ezekiel Carrera and Kevin Pillar hit homers off you, Darvish, in the same inning.
4 homers of Darvish.
Yeah, 3 in one inning.
Pillar is on a pitch that was above his head.
It was 4.2 feet off the ground.
He swung at it like with a tennis racket and it went over the fence. Yeah.
And so that's kind of when, and that's what the biggest surprise for me was, that they were just completely snuffed by the Indians offensively, because it looked like those 4 games of the playoffs, the wild card and the sweep, they were back. The offense was fine. Everything was going to be great. They were going to steamroll Cleveland, and there you go.
That leads nicely to what I think is my definitive moment, and what the moment I think that encapsulates what this Blue Jays season was, and that was the 5 innings of Ryan Merritt, or the 4 2/3, or whatever it ended up being. The fact that, a guy who really had no business starting game 5 of an ALCS, He had 11 big league innings. He's farting to get his stuff up to 87, right? Like, he just had nothing. And he just attacked him with curveballs and attacked him with changeups and off speed. And the Blue Jays, I think they had three of their five or six strikeouts against him were looking like guys were like just taking strikes and arguing with umpires about strikes, like balls that were in the zone. And to me, that encapsulated what this team, what was probably most frustrating for fans about this team this year, is that you would get just these kind of soft tossing, like kind of finesse guys who would just carve the Blue Jays up with breaking balls and with off speed and by not giving in. And in a lot of ways, that's, I think, why the Blue Jays had a lot of struggles offensively this year, is they just couldn't master that variety of pitcher.
I think that's harsh just because, I mean, you're right 100% about, you know, this guy had no business doing what he did to them. But when you get a team that, again, gets to the Final Four and is one of the last teams standing, to say that the defining moment is a negative and how they're frustrating and how they couldn't hit, I think that's, I mean, I guess that's what we're left with, right? But it was, it sort of, for me, takes the shine off of what was a very successful year.
That's fair.
When you look at it in the overall.
It's a critical way of looking at it. But like, how many times did you see a soft tossing lefty come in and go like six innings of one run ball against the Blue Jays? Oh, you know?
Well, that's, it happened a lot. Compared to 2015, when it seemed like the Jays, with the occasional exception, the Jays did such a good job of hammering weak pitching.
Yeah, everybody but Adam Morgan.
Yeah, that was the Phillies lefty. Yeah. So that's really the difference. And that was a big contrast between the two seasons.
But you know, at the same time, If you're just thinking about it in hindsight, was it unreasonable on all our parts to expect the 2015 offense to just replicate itself again season? I mean,
I expected it to be better.
I mean, and realistically, I mean, you had so many guys having like peak years, right?
But you got nothing out of second base for 100 games in 2015 offensively. You got nothing out of left field for the first 4 months of the season offensively. Shortstop was a zero offensively. In 2015, Tulowitzki was awful and Jose Reyes was barely passable for most of the year. So I thought with healthy Saunders, healthy Tulo, healthy Travis, why wouldn't the offense be better?
But you're going to, that's counting everyone to remain at peak form and to remain healthy.
But you didn't think Donaldson, Edwin, and Bautista were going to fall back. Bautista did. Because he couldn't stay healthy. But we all thought of him as somebody who, you know, we believe this whole I'm defying age, the Arden Swelling theory of never growing old, right? So I didn't think it was unreasonable that even if they did fall back a bit, the gains made in the middle infield and in left field would be massive.
I can see your point, but I just think, again, you had so many guys who were performing at peak in 2015 that, to expect a complete repeat, expect them to lead the majors by 125, 126 runs, whatever it was, was unlikely, because it's hard to have that many guys have that big years. I mean, you had 120 homers in the middle of your lineup. You can't count on that year after year after year.
No, absolutely wonder, not.
You look at the rotation from this year.
Yeah. Bit of a cautionary tale, perhaps.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And also same for the Red Sox, too. You know, I mean, the Red Sox, they still have some upside in their lineup, right? I mean, you're going to have Benintendi for a full year. You know, maybe their Betts hasn't peaked, you would think. Bradley Jr. probably hasn't peaked. So, I mean, they may still have some upside in that lineup. But are they going to be able to be as good a lineup again next year, especially now that they're going to give Mitch Moreland a ton of at-bats?
Yeah, that they gave to a guy with 1,000 OPS last year,
right? Exactly.
That's going to be a big problem that nobody seems to be talking about. But also, I think, like you, it's hard to imagine that they repeat it, just because we've seen it just now. And even though Mookie Betts is way younger, we know the progress doesn't happen in a straight line upward, right? He'll slip back. Maybe Jackie Bradley turns back into Jackie Bradley.
Right.
Maybe Benintendi's first full season doesn't go particularly well, right?
Which is all fair.
Yeah. They're looking to Pablo Sandoval to play third base.
Yeah.
And that's a massive question mark.
Absolutely.
You don't know what you're going to get. Adults beware. you don't know what you're going to get out of them.
Right.
Interesting stuff.
Are you going to get another year like that from Sandy Leone going to hit 360?
Right. Is Hanley Ramirez going to be able to go through another season without pouting?
Right.
Well, he doesn't have to play first base anymore. Wow. He's got that.
Well, I'm sure they can find something.
We'll move on to our next question. We'll start with Mike, moving on around the table here. Which member of the 2016 Blue Jays was the most underappreciated?
It's a two-way tie. Jimmy Paredes and Chris Smith.
Yes.
They're appropriately rated.
I liked Jimmy Paredes. I had a good chat with him when he first joined the club. He was an interesting guy.
He's the Phil Koch of 2016.
Yeah, totally. He was an interesting guy to talk to.
Yeah, I don't know if I got the chance. He wasn't around long enough. And Chris Smith, of course, called up in September and never pitched. I think it was Troy Tulowitzki. I think people really don't appreciate both sides of what he does. First of all, a phenomenal defensive shortstop. Makes every play and doesn't make the first baseman work. Turns a double play beautifully. Has more range than I thought he did. And he's just such a dependable defender. And after what we saw with Jose Reyes, especially the last couple of weeks before he got traded, but even the whole season before, I mean, we see what a difference that makes. And I think quietly, he had a very good year offensively. I know people hate picking arbitrary endpoints, but sometimes it shows you that things change. And up until May 9th, Troy Tulowitzki was an absolute zero offensively. He had the worst 5 weeks of almost anyone that I've ever seen. We were questioning his vision. Does he need to go see an eye doctor? You know, arguing strikes all the time. And then from May 10th on, he had like an 840 OPS. And he was very, very good again. And I don't know that still, I think that first impression from 2015 has left a bad taste in a lot of fans' mouths. And I think they really don't appreciate all the things that Troy Tulowitzki does. Off the field, it's a whole other story, right? He is the guy that everybody turns to, the total pro, the clubhouse leader, if you will, the quiet, whatever. But on the field, he does a lot of stuff.
Shy?
He did get some praise, but I think if you in the grand scheme of things, without Joe Biagini, where is this team? And, you know, you just if you think about some of the assumptions that you make going into the season, that Drew Storen and Brett Cecil are going to be, you know, two shutdown setup guys. You know, the Blue Jays might not have survived April, May as well as they did if not for Gavin Floyd and Joe Biagini, which is a remarkable thing to say, but it's true. And then you think about the 70 innings he provided, the way he helped support Jason Grilley once he arrived, eventually Joaquin Benoit, and how once Benoit went down, again, he was thrust into a very critical high-leverage role. You know, the Blue Jays would have been in big trouble if Joe Biagini didn't deliver, and that is a ton to get from a Rule 5 pick who had never thrown a pitch above AA before.
At the end of the year, in late September and October, as Jason Grilley was starting to struggle and give up home runs, Joe Biagini was number two on the depth chart in the bullpen after Osuna.
Right.
And he had a crappy September, but he didn't give up a home run until September.
Yeah.
And it was great again in October.
Well, he had this period where he ran out of gas because of all the usage that he had, and then he picked it up again towards the end of the season and then didn't give up a run in the postseason. So, I mean, he was invaluable.
For me, it's Russell Martin who's the most underappreciated. When you look at what we were talking about, what the pitching staff was able to do, you know, I don't know if it's possible to give him enough credit just for handling the pitchers and calling pitches. And you've got a lot of guys on that staff who just don't shake. You know, Estrada doesn't shake. You know, Cecil moved to a point where he wasn't shaking. Hap doesn't shake much. You don't even, you know, Stroman, who is, you know, one of the cockier guys in that group, doesn't shake much. You know, he mostly just throws what's put down. And this is a guy who, just because Josh Tolley existed for the last few years, has logged a ton of innings. You know, the second most to Sal Perez in the American League. And this is a guy who's in his 30s and doing that and playing through injuries. And he had that knee issue that cropped up from when he slipped in the sauna. And I think that bothered him a lot more than he ever let on. Like, I think that was a pretty significant thing for him. And he played through it, didn't complain, you know, didn't gripe or anything. And when, you know, he doesn't get the credit I think that he deserves for it. He is one of the better offensive catchers in baseball. Over the last 2 years in terms of OPS, he is second to only Buster Posey among major league catchers. I mean, this is a really, really good offensive catcher. Even with, you think about that massive chasm he fell into for April and most of May, he didn't have he had one extra base hit through his first 120 plate appearances. Something crazy like that, and he still has put up really good offensive numbers. So I think Russ Martin's the guy that really, you can never give him enough credit for the impact he makes on this team.
Yeah, I completely agree. That was my pick as well. And I think you made the case very well, so I won't add much to it. But I just think that, you know, you look around the game at how good defensive catchers are getting paid, and particularly framers. Obviously, Martin is part of that trend. But, you know, even as his contract starts to pick up and he's going to be earning close to $20 million over the course of the next three seasons, well, I actually think that he's still probably worth it. You know, and if he was a free agent right now, I don't know what he gets. Maybe it's not quite as much as he's going to make, but he's an underrated piece of this team, I think.
It's an interesting question if you look at the Castro contract, and that was 24 over three.
And he hasn't hit at all in 2 years.
Yeah. Right. It's like, I mean, you're paying for framing and occasional power, but largely hollow power. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's not unreasonable to think that Russell Martin gets fairly easily three at 15.
Yeah. I think that's probably what he would get if he was a free agent. Something like 3 times 15.
It's so rare that you find a catcher who can hit, really. And I don't think fans appreciate enough, like, how rare it is. Like, you look at a guy like Yadier Molina, like, I'm quickly pulling it up here. This is like a barely an 800 OPS guy. And he's one of the, you know, renowned as one of the best all-around catchers in baseball.
Well, but for a long time, though, he was a much better hitter, no?
Yeah, I'm sure he was. But yeah. I'm talking about right now.
Yeah, now, absolutely. Well, still, but you live on reputation for a long time, right? But I know that if Russell Martin has another bad April, the hot takes will be coming fast, right? He's done, and is he ever going to hit again and all that stuff. But the fact that he was able, I don't know if he hit, did he hit 20 home runs this year?
Yeah, he did.
The fact that he was able to get to that when he had like 3 at the end of May or whatever.
He hit exactly 20. Yeah.
I mean, he carried them offensively for a couple months there.
August, he was so good.
Yeah, and parts of July, if I'm remembering correctly, too. He was pretty crucial to them. So the thing that's impressive is that not only is he able to produce offensively, but to produce offensively when you're carrying that much of a workload behind the plate. I think it was 1,069 innings last season, which is and this is, we have to remember too, this is not an easy staff to catch. I mean,
no.
Sanchez is high 90s all over the place. Osuna's like that. Happ is no picnic. Stroman's stuff moves all over the place with a lot of velocity. Osuna, Grilli,
Liriano.
Yeah. Talk about tough to catch. Liriano.
Right, absolutely. So, I mean, he's taken an awful beating out behind the plate. He comes to play every day, plays through injury, and he still delivers at the plate. I mean, it really is remarkable.
So what do we think happens? I know we're looking back, but to look ahead, now in 2017, he won't have to catch every day game after a night game unless R.A. Dickey's pitching. He won't have to. He can get a rest after he catches 3 days in a row or whatever. Are we going to see, you think, an uptick? Or is it just going to be way too hard for John Gibbons to resist putting his name in there 130 times if he can?
Yeah, I wonder if they're going to back off of him as much as they say they are. I think it's too tempting to put a guy like that out there just as much as possible, especially considering the options at backup catcher aren't exactly sexy ones.
Well, it depends. I mean, if they get someone like Alex Avila or Chris Iannetta, I think that's a different conversation than if it's AJ Jimenez, right? So right. If it's AJ Jimenez, you know, it's maybe Josh Tolley plus, you know, but you're not talking about someone you really want out there 50 times a year. But if you have Iannetta or Avila or Soto or someone who's a little bit more palatable, 50 games, 50, 55 games is not unrealistic for the back.
It would be crazy if we had to watch Giovanni Soto do that weird throw the ball back to the pitcher act.
The yips.
60, 70 times games. That would just be nuts. I don't know what I would do.
You know what he's talking about, eh? He, like, rubs the dirt. Yeah. And
on the throw down. After.
It's gross.
Yeah, he's got the thing. Bad.
I'm shuddering just thinking about it. It's bad. The only thing is Russ Martin wants to play as much as possible. Very competitive guy. So, it's going to be a difficult discussion to have with him to say, hey, you're sitting 2 to 3 times a week.
And he's going to have an easier spring training this year, right? Because for at least a couple of weeks, he won't be catching.
Yeah, World Baseball Classic.
We were having that discussion on a couple of pods ago where how everyone's saying, how could they let him play third base?
Shortstop,
whatever. It's so dangerous. You know, he might get hurt. The guy's like standing, you know, catching 97-mile-an-hour heaters from Aaron Sanchez, taking foul tips off the groin and face, like... It's way more dangerous to be a catcher than it is to go play shortstop.
Yeah, you don't get blown up at second base anymore. No. So, you know, you don't have to worry about that. But it's going to be very, very interesting to watch Russell Martin play the middle infield.
It's going to be a relief for him. Like, it's going to be a break. Yeah. I think it's going to be a good little mental break for him. Like, I think it'll just be a good little, like, you know, just, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it especially helps that he doesn't have, he's not going to have too many new pitchers to get to know. I mean, pretty much he knows everyone there. It's going to be a couple of relievers he has to figure out. So I think that from that end of it, look, I've covered every World Baseball Classic so far, and guys, when they're there, they have a great time, and a lot of times they struggle when they get back to spring training, because it's like you're at this level where you're really enjoying it, and then you get back to spring training, it's like, man, this is boring and monotonous. Can the season please just start?
Right. And Canada's really only going to play 3 games anyway. So
I think they're going to play at least 4. Yeah. That's my prediction.
So you think they're getting out of their pool?
Not necessarily, but I think they're at least getting to the tiebreaker in their pool.
Interesting.
The first time there's not going to be the tiebreaker is not math. There will actually be a game. So I think Canada will beat one of the U.S. or the Dominican and beat Colombia, and there will be a 3-way tie for first, a 2-1,
right,
and then there will be a playoff game.
Doesn't Colombia have Jose Quintana? Am I wrong on that? Someone was mentioning that to me. I don't know.
I might have just made that up. Internet's right.
Yeah, there. I do. I could look it up really quickly. I don't know. I it's hard to just looking at the way Canada's performed at these. Yeah, he's Colombian, Jose Quintana.
Canada's been the best the way team in the World Baseball Classic that hasn't made it out of the first round every single year.
Yeah.
But they got eliminated by math twice.
Actually, not in 2009.
Well, not the year when it was here. Yeah.
Yeah, they lost to the U.S. and they lost to Italy. And they lost without using their best pitcher. And their best pitcher was Scott Richmond. Which, no disrespect to Scott Richmond,
disrespect to Canada,
who may be back on the 2016 team as well, or 2017 team.
Yeah, he'll start the game against Colombia, bro.
Is Jameson Taillon? Is he there? Who's their best?
Not letting him go.
No,
Paxton.
Who's gonna be the guy?
Yeah, Paxton. They're gonna have James Paxton.
So do you throw him against the States or the Dominican?
That's a good question.
Thank you.
Would depend. Depends on what the schedule is, right?
Like the U.S. is the last game,
so you may not want to leave it to that. You may try to beat the Dominican right off the bat, and then you've got a second chance against the United States.
Yeah, I think that you would revert the strategy from last time, where you're saving your best guy. Yeah. Throw your best guy. Throw him right away.
Well,
get a win.
In the first one in Phoenix, they saved their best guy for Mexico, Jeff Francis.
Right.
And he got his ears pinned.
I mean, that went totally backwards, right? Because Adam Loewen, who had never been above double A at the time.
Maybe not even double A.
Maybe A-ball, beats the U.S., you know, and then the game they have to win. And it looks like they're totally set up. You know, Jeff Francis gets crushed.
He gave up 6 runs in the first.
Right, with 2 outs, too.
Esteban Loaiza beat them.
And then Esteban Loaiza shuts them down. So
awful.
And then they pound Dontrell Willis with their lefty-lefty, yeah, and then they get the righty, and Loaiza eats him up. So
that's the thing. Baseball's too unpredictable.
Don't predict ball. You just can't.
Yeah, you can't get too cute with it. We'll go to Shy to start this one. Was there ever a point during the 2016 season when you felt John Gibbons was close to being let go?
No, I don't think they ever got to the point where that was a serious consideration. And they, you know, the September was bleak, about as bleak a period as I can remember with this team, especially given the circumstances. But, you know, there's always griping, there's always complaints, but I don't know that you can look at much that happened last year and say, oh, that was John Gibbons' fault. And I think you can make the case that he did a pretty good job of keeping things together. You know, a group that, you know, can be a bit high maintenance, or a lot of egos, a lot of personalities, a lot of guys going through different things with sometimes competing interests. And, you know, somehow he managed to keep them together. And you look at the way he managed in the postseason. Yeah, he had a home field advantage in the wild card game, but you know, he managed to beat the manager who invented baseball, Buck Showalter, in a postseason game. And you know, he lined everything right against Texas, and then, you know, against Cleveland. It certainly appeared the Jays were set up to just cruise it or waltz their way into the World Series, but not much you can do when guys stop hitting. So I never got the sense that was ever even discussed in semi-serious way in any part of the organization.
Yeah, I would agree with that, because I think that the real low point of that season came in September. Like you said, you don't fire a manager in September. There's just no sense in doing it that late in the season unless you've got a massive problem.
Or unless you're the Milwaukee Brewers.
Yeah, 08,
or the
right?
81 Expos.
So it's happened twice in the last 35 years, is what we're saying. You know, unless you've got really, really significant problems, right. You don't really let a guy, it's weird to do it that late in the season, just do it in the off season. Why bother with it? But yeah, the Blue Jays never had like a situation like they had a couple years ago when they were going to Washington and it was like, oh wow, this is bad. They didn't have one of those kind of in the early to mid part of the season.
Yeah, I never thought that there was a point where Gibbons was close to being let go. I did, you know, being honest, I did wonder in September about Brooke Jacoby just because the offense wasn't delivering at all. And sometimes there are fall people for that kind of thing. But there was never a point that I wondered about Gibby.
Well, they resolved the Brooke Jacoby issue by getting him more quality control for this year. So that's going to help. I don't think in season there was ever a point for me. But if they had gotten swept in Boston, I don't think he'd be back. And if they had lost a wild card game, I'm not sure he would be back. I don't think it would have been the right move because I think he's terrific and he did a good, very good job with what he had to deal with, all the stuff that Chai said. And you know, trying to keep a team afloat in a pennant race when they're just collapsing and their fires breaking out all around, it's a tough thing to do. And however, you know, John Gibbons does that, he's not going to go into the clubhouse and throw a chair or scream at people or anything like that. But he does it very well. But I do think that if they hadn't made the playoffs, he would be out and probably if they'd lost a wild card game.
Yeah, that's how we should have phrased this. If the Baltimore Orioles win the wild card game, is Bud Black the manager of the Blue Jays right now?
I would have said yes.
Probably.
Probably, yeah.
Most likely.
Yeah, I really wonder. I thought that it just would have been so tough to let him go when the offense disappeared. I mean, the players just weren't hitting, and that's because they're banged up. But are you gonna fire John Gibbons because he plays Josh Donaldson every day and Donaldson gets banked up and then his power diminishes? And so, like, to me, that doesn't seem like it's his fault.
Right, but it would have been the opportunity. And Bud Black was the next manager of this team until he found another job. So.
And he might still be. You never know how long things last. But the question, I think, is how much faith do we put in the things that Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins say about John Gibbons, about how great he is and how much they love him and how much they learned about him this year and how much they've come around? Would we have heard all that if they had lost a wildcard game?
Right. And I guess it would be easier to dismiss the comments that they make if you didn't hear that kind of thing from a lot of other people in the game. Like, I think John Gibbons is very well liked.
Yeah.
And so
I respect
it. Yeah, and respect it too. So he might not be the tactical X's and O's mastermind that some fans would like him to be.
He's no Buck Showalter.
Right. But he still brings enough that I think they legitimately like him. I don't think that they're legitimate. They're trying to find ways to fire him.
I still think he's the first guy to fall if next year doesn't play out right. I mean, all the things, I do legitimately believe that, you know, the new front office and John Gibbons got along well and had productive relationships. But ultimately, I just think they're different baseball tribes. And at some point, and you know what? I'd understand this from the front office perspective, because every front office wants their own guy there. And they inherited John Gibbons, and there was no reason to let him go because everything was going well. But ultimately, I would think that they're going to want their own guy. So when things go wrong, I would see him ending up being the guy who pays for it.
If things do go sideways this year and he does get the axe, do you think he gets it with a contract extension that he'd already signed?
Yeah, I don't see how they don't give him a contract extension.
Feels like a first day of spring training type of thing, right? Feels like one of those. You know, we were pleased to, now that you're all here in Dunedin, we're pleased to announce we've extended John Gibbons.
Yeah.
Or it's one of those, hey, our new left fielder's Brandon Moss, but hey, look over here.
Yeah, the Red Sox just signed Encarnacion, but that's not going to happen.
Ezekiel Carrera is going to play 140 games, but hey, we got Gibby.
I'm not sure that satisfies anyone in the fan base. I can't see anybody being like, oh yeah, I think either way, you're pissing somebody off. Yeah. It's like, all right, we can live with Brandon Moss, but not Gibby, or we can live with Gibby, but not Brandon Moss. But there's no one's going to be like, all right, we're cool with everything.
Look, if the Blue Jays start the year 10-20, everybody's going to be calling for Gibby's head anyway.
I mean, mm-hmm. Yep.
The way she's going to go. The next one, and I guess it's my turn to start. Which 2016 Blue Jays pitcher was the most fun to watch? And for me, I'm going to go off the board. I'm going to go with Marco Estrada. because I truly enjoy a Marco Estrada start. Just the way he carves, the way he approaches hitters, you know, the fact that the guy has like a nothing fastball and still gets all kinds of swing and miss, the fact that everybody knows he's trying to get to his changeup and it's just too tempting, and it's just so easy to swing over even though hitters are expecting it, even though hitters know that it's coming. His deception between his fastball and changeup is awesome to watch. And just the fact that he had a really, really nice year, and if not for some injury troubles, he could have had a much better year. He had a really nice year when, you know, everybody was questioning whether he was going to be able to do it without DeAndre Navarro and whether it would work with Russell Martin. And, I mean, he was even better with Russell Martin this year. So, you know, Marco Estrada, I think, has just taken such strides late in his career, especially in terms of mentality and confidence on the mound, and just, you know, really becoming a complete pitcher and really, you know, realizing his potential. So I really do enjoy watching a Marco Estrada start.
Yeah, that's a good choice. I think there are actually a lot of good choices. I want to give Pat Venditti an honorable mention because watching him truly was fun.
Very cool.
But my pick is Aaron Sanchez. I just think he's the exact type of pitcher that I like watching when you have that big fastball and then the curveball to complement it. To me, there aren't many pitchers in baseball who, especially I think when they're young, there's something a bit more fun about watching a pitcher because they're figuring out who they are. You're kind of getting to know them as a pitcher. But that's the exact type of pitcher that I like watching. So he's easily number one for me.
For Estrada, I think a lot of people can win a lot of bar bets if you just go and say, you know, who's the major league pitcher who has the all-time record for most consecutive starts of at least six innings and five hits or less?
Yeah.
Who's going to say Marco Estrada? But that's what we saw this year. From a fun perspective, Pat Venditti, absolutely. R.A. Dickey, I think, and we're going to forget, you know, we saw a knuckleballer every fifth day for 4 years, and that's pretty cool, and he was a lot better than a lot of people give him credit for. From a sadomasochistic perspective, I think Drew Storen would be your answer there, you know, if you enjoy that sort of thing. But I'm going to go with Ben, and I think Aaron Sanchez in the overall, right, because he's that prototypical. You know, Bob McCowan was on the air yesterday talking about Aaron Sanchez, and he said he thinks by the time he's done, he's going to be the greatest pitcher in Blue Jays history. And that's a stretch because wow. Dave Steeb and Roy Halladay are both Hall of Famers, even though Steeb never got a sniff. But the fact that he's got that potential, that you can see that in him,
yeah,
that's really exciting.
Drew Storen's a great call because you knew it was going to be interesting. Like, you knew you were in for a wild ride, one way or the other.
I didn't think so at all. I thought, and I said it a million times in spring training, Cecil Storen, Asuna, they're not the big names that the Yankees have or the Red Sox in the back right. of their bullpen, but they're going to be just as good. And wow, I have rarely been that wrong.
But you knew, like, by May, when you saw Drew Storen coming out of the bullpen, you had an idea that something, there's going to be some fireworks here one way or the other,
like, right? That guy looks a lot like Francisco Cordero.
Yeah, right. Like, I better start rewriting. Exactly. Or he'll fall behind 3-0 and then snap off like three perfect sliders to get swing and miss, right? Because he had such great stuff.
And he had a run there, I think, like five outings in a row where he gave up a double to the first guy he faced and then boom, 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 and he was out of it. It was so insane. I mean, how legitimately a guy who had been great, and people talk about second half of 2015, but that's a load. It was one bad week, four bad outings in 2015. Other than that, he had an ERA under two, and he was phenomenal. And he was just awful for 4 months.
It's a guy with 100 saves in the major leagues. You can say what you want about saves.
Just awful.
Yeah, totally.
Coming off a good year.
I bet you Francisco Cordero had 100 saves too, though. Maybe more.
Yeah,
might have 200. Yeah.
That means they were good at one point.
Right.
That's what that means.
That's when you catch them.
Do you want the Francisco Cordero has 329 saves in his major league career? Yeah, 329.
How many with the Jays? Like eight?
Two. Two with the Jays and a 5.77 ERA, and 34 and a third.
I remember, I'm having visions of him. Did he give up a walk off grand slam in Oakland?
Yes,
and then that was the last time. I think that was his last save opportunity. And then went to Casey Jansen.
That's when
after
he went
that.
To Jansen. Yeah, I think that was his third consecutive blown save.
In Oakland, he gave up a five spot in a third.
Yeah, it was a walk-off grand slam. I can't remember
two
who
walks. Yeah,
it went over the left field fence, though.
It was Brandon Inge.
It was Brandon Inge.
Nice.
Yes, wow. It was.
Memories of rewrites wow. past.
These are the things that fill your brain when you do this job, eh? Like, this is what you
use. The things that haunt you.
You use years. Your brain storage on this kind of stuff.
And then the next day in the Oakland clubhouse, before it was covered in rivers of poo, we all gathered around Casey Jansen's locker because we knew what was coming.
Right.
There was
right.
no way Frankie was going back out there.
No. No, it was not. What do you got, Shai? Most fun pitcher to watch?
Well, I mean, it's impossible to argue against Sanchez and Estrada. And there is something special about watching a guy like Aaron Sanchez really come into his own and start figuring out, okay, I've got these amazing pitches and I've got this unbelievable stuff. But now he's starting to figure out how to use it. And that's really cool to watch. But I'll just to be different, I'll go with Marcus Stroman. And I really like guys who are emotive on the field. And I think baseball needs to stop trying to suppress the personality of these guys and let them have some fun and let them engage people and let them connect to a younger generation. And Marcus Stroman is just one of those guys. He takes them out. He's got a ton of energy. He's yelling at himself. He's pumping up his teammates. You can tell right away when he's excited. And I think that's great for the game. I think there's a lot of entertainment value to that. And then, you know, you factor in the way he can spin the ball, all the different pitches that he has, the when his breaking ball is on, the way that it dives out of the zone. I think there's a lot of entertainment there.
He's a bit unhinged on the mound. Like, he's a bit of a maniac. Who was it? Logan Morrison that got upset at him for yelling, was it? Or
yeah. Right?
But he's like
opening day.
But he was yelling at
Stroman's,
himself.
He's yelling at himself. Like, this is a man who's yelling at himself on the mound to the extent that players on the other team think that he's yelling at them.
But that's what it's
cool.
But that's part of the baseball culture, right? Yeah. Like, they hate that. You're supposed to be like cool, calm, collected, never show a hint of emotion and all that stuff. You're supposed to be this robot on the field. You know, in a sense, you know, Troy Tulowitzki is almost that. You know, it's just, you can never tell whether he's 0 for 4 or 4 for 4, except in very rare moments where you get like the emotion bursts out.
Was the one at the end of the game with Osuna and...
when he went to break up that... Well, he Osuna, thought he was breaking up a fight, but he was starting a fight.
He was starting it. Yeah.
He sprinted over.
Who was it with?
It was with Steven Souza.
Steven Souza.
Because...
And there's a miscommunication with Russ.
With Russ Martin.
He had hit a ball 399 feet to center. Pilar caught against the wall. And Russ said something like, oh, I thought you got it. Yeah. And he thought Martin had chirped him. So he turned around to say something to Martin. Osuna came in to be peacemaker. And then Troy Tulowitzki came in ready to bulldoze everybody.
That was because there was the horn had gone off for like a foul tip or something.
Right.
Osuna had celebrated.
Before, yeah.
Right. Yeah, right. So people thought Souza was pissed off about that.
Right.
And then everybody kind of decided, oh, it was all a misunderstanding. It's okay. And then here comes Tulo.
He's looking for blood. Yeah. Absolutely.
Ready to go.
That was awesome. But I think that the whole idea of the baseball, you know, the culture, it's so incredibly hypocritical, right? Because the people who rail against it the most are very happy to celebrate when they do something, right? That's a huge moment. It's okay. So, I mean, I like Stroman for that, but I think if we're discussing that, we also have to mention Jason Grilli. Mm-hmm. Because that right. man walking off the mound after a big strikeout is just ridiculous and so much fun for people to watch that.
You talk about maniacs on the mound. Like, he is so in the zone. It is crazy. He does that thing where before he even gets the sign, he looks down for like a good five count and then comes up.
Which would be so damn annoying if he pitched for another two.
Right. I mean, it's like forget the other stuff, but that's like watching Jonathan Papelbon, right?
Yeah. With Papelbon like, face.
With that dumb stare. Yeah. And
Kimbrel to
and
a certain
Kimbrel
extent,
with the
too.
Thing. Yeah.
I kind of like that stuff, man. It's cool. It's quirky.
I think it's a little... self-indulgent.
A bit much.
A little look at me.
But that's okay. But that's okay. And that's where I think the sport has to go to a certain
but
degree.
But I don't mind if it's spontaneous, but I think if it's like
the regimented.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
like the Al Raboski stuff from 30 years ago.
Or Turk Wendell.
Yeah.
Everybody's got their process. You know, everybody's got their way of getting in the zone.
I like the pure emotion of it, the Stroman stuff, what Grilli does when he comes off the mound, that sort of thing.
Right.
But, you know, the other stuff is a little too look at me.
Do you don't think the Grilli stuff is also a bit contrived?
Looking down?
No, the coming off the mound.
No, I mean, I think he knows he's going to get pumped up, but I think it's different every time. And when it's a big spot, it's bigger. And I think that's real.
Ben's nodding his head.
Yeah, I think that to some extent we know he's going to do it if he strikes someone out. To another extent, I agree with Mike that you do end up seeing after a big strikeout, a couple men on, you see him really react.
Yeah, there are levels. It's not like Paul O'Neill beating the hell out of a Gatorade thing, so everyone knows how angry he is.
Or Ben Revere. Didn't Ben Revere come off after the in game six and KC come out and after he got that called strikeout or whatever it was and he like just beat the crap out of the cooler?
Maybe, but I didn't see it on a monitor, so I don't know.
That situation, it's fair. If you're going to pound a cooler, that's a spot when, you know, you've got a chance to lesson two, a chance to drive in the tying run in game six of the ALCS when your season's on the line. I mean, if you're ever going to excuse a guy for doing some damage to a cooler, I think that's it.
I don't think you should ever sabotage your teammate's hydration. That's what I think.
Thing is, there's always another cooler.
There's always some lackey to go get the backup cooler.
You know, it's just speaking of, and this is a little aside, isn't it amazing that the Orioles could find the phone that David Ortiz smashed up and then presented to him as a going away present?
Awesome,
like,
present.
Like, how did they, who kept that and thought, you know what, we should have this just in case.
Maybe
like,
it was in the Orioles Hall of Fame all these years.
They may have just smashed a phone. It may not have been authentic.
Very possible.
Yeah, I think there's a conspiracy at play there. We'll go to Ben. It's Ben's turn. What's a reasonable expectation for Troy Tulowitzki in 2017?
I'm going to say 125 games, 20 homers, 330 on base, 450 slugging, 3 WAR.
That's all right.
That's very specific.
That's very specific.
What do you guys
think? That is off of where he was in his hay.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. He's definitely not the Troy Tulowitzki of old, in my opinion.
Do you think he's better than he showed last year?
Yeah, a little better. Maybe about the same as last year, a little better. I don't expect a totally different player, but I think he was a good player last year, and I think that's a reasonable expectation going forward.
My expectations, I think, are a little higher. I think he's probably going to wind up missing a month at some point, but he'll hit 280. I expect an OPS over 800, 25 to 30 homers, and continued very, very reliable defense at shortstop.
Yep.
He has not had an OPS over 800 since 2014, when he only played 91 games.
Yeah, but 2015 was that lost 2 months with the Blue Jays where he was just awful, and last year he had 6 weeks of being just awful too.
I guess the question is this what Troy Tulowitzki is now? You know, like just the, like, so for the last couple of years, he's basically had a 760 OPS.
But when you break it down, right,
Tulowitzki,
maybe you arbitrary endpoint it. But in 2015, before he got traded to the Jays, he was hitting 300 with an OPS, I think, close to 900. And then last year after May 10th, again, he had the OPS over 800.
But I think if you're going to give him credit for the peaks, you have to acknowledge the valleys as well.
But it was a three-month valley that was an amazingly deep valley. So 3 months of awful and 8 months of quite good.
Right.
But the 3 months of awful have a lot of weight.
I think you have to remember the good, too. And now that he's had some time to get used to American League pitchers and really had a chance to learn the league, I think you can expect a bit of an uptick over the course and see more of the second half Troy Tulowitzki as opposed to the first half Tulowitzki. But I still think very similar numbers, expectations to go as I think probably were somewhere around an 800 OPS, you know, and continuing to be the elite defender at shortstop that he was. And if you can get that from him, I really think that's all you need, combined with all the intangibles that he brings, the seriousness that he brings to that clubhouse, the determination he brings to that clubhouse, the management he brings to that clubhouse. All those elements are, in a lot of ways, an integral part of the package that you're getting. So, you know, if he's giving you numbers like that, plus all those intangibles, I think you're talking about a superstar caliber of player, even though maybe not the flashy 900 OPS that you might expect.
That's the thing, because I'm kind of two minds on this, because this was a 900, even 950 OPS guy at one point. And if this is what he is now, his decline has been just steep, and then it's kind of plateaued. It hasn't been a real gradual decline. Like, it just kind of fell off a cliff.
Well, what was his worst year with the Rockies?
What was
and how recent
year?
Was that? You know, don't forget the Colorado effect, too.
Absolutely. Right? His worst year with the Rockies was 2008, when he had a 732 OPS. But then 09, 930, 949, 916, 846, 931, 1.035 in 2014.
And what was it in Colorado in 2015?
In Colorado in 2015, it was 818.
I mean, his decline
is just steep, right?
What are the home road splits on his career numbers? I'd be curious of what is OPS's career at home versus road. And then if he's more of an 800 OPS kind of player, then I think that you've got a little bit of an answer there.
This helps your case. His career home road OPS splits at home, 926, on the road, 802.
So maybe that's what he is, away from Colorado.
And there's nothing wrong with that at shortstop.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's a really good player.
No, yeah, if he can, I mean, the defense is so elite. And like Mike mentioned, the juxtaposition of him and the guy who came before him is, I mean, it's jarring. But, you know, I see, like, there's part of me that thinks maybe there is just a bit more consistency in his bat. Like, it's just, I don't know, it's hard for me to imagine that his decline has been that steep. Like, I wonder if he can bounce back and have one more All-star type,
but is it decline or is it just
right?
This is what you are outside.
But
of
he wasn't this streaky in Colorado. At least it doesn't seem that way. I haven't looked into it.
In his last 20 at bats as a Rocky,
when he
came to Toronto,
that's a 20 at bat,
and he had that one 20 at bat sample where he had 13 homers in 14 games or something.
Yeah,
so I feel like there was a little streakiness there.
Maybe what he is an 800 or so OPS guy outside of Coors Field.
What I would point to as strange as that, or I don't know, maybe telling, is that his strikeouts are way up in the last couple of years. And that's not something that Coors Field should be, I don't know, maybe balls don't break the same way in the atmosphere. I don't know how much weight you want to put into that. But I mean, this is a guy who, you know, he went from having pretty consistently like a 13 to 14% strikeout rate to 21% in 2015 and then 18.6% in 2016.
So like, that's down in 2016. And I'll bet you, if you look at it, I don't know if you can get specific, but I'll bet you post May 10th, it was back down to where it normally was, because those first 6 weeks of the season felt like he was striking out three times a game.
A big question too is that, I mean, the Jays as a lineup struck out a ton last season and significantly higher than 2015. And is that something that is that a notable team-wise trend? Was that just they got pitched a different way and they didn't adjust well enough or fast enough? Or was that this roster started getting old and some bat speed declined and that's it? So, I mean, or is it a combination thereof? And that's an interesting question.
Seven guys on the Blue Jays struck out 100 times or more, and one of them was not Kevin Pillar. Like, Kevin Pillar was not one of them, which is kind of crazy to think about.
Yeah.
Because he chases everything, and he only struck out 90 times. Seven guys struck out more than him.
Just on the Coors Field thing, I just think it's hard to overstate how big of an impact that park has. And when you look back at the last three batting title champions in the NL, two of them, you have an aging Justin Morneau, and you have DJ LeMahieu. That's two of the three. I mean, that's what Coors Field does. Yeah, it's a great place to
And get. It's not just that the ball carries, right? The outfield is massive. There's so much room out there. Little doink shots fall in a lot more often. There's lots of gap. So it's not just homer.
No wonder Troy Tulowitzki was so upset to be traded. He saw it coming. We'll start with Mike on this one. Do the Blue Jays acquire a bigger name than Jay Bruce by opening day?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think Jay Bruce is even really that big a name anymore. And with all the holes they have to fill, but I do think they do. I don't know who it's going to be, but I mean, we need to remember that it's still 2016 and people are all very, very worried about 2017. They're not going to go into the season with an outfield of Upton, Pillar, and Carrera.
And Pierce.
Yeah, and Pierce. It's just, there's going to be some talent brought in. They've got some money to spend. Someone will be here.
Shy? Bigger name than Jay Bruce.
I'm going to say probably, but I do believe there is a debate internally as to whether it's better to spend smaller amounts on multiple spots than spend big on one spot and less in other areas. And I think the way that the board's still set up with the free agents and potential trade pieces that are still out there is that the Blue Jays can still go either way. And my guess on what's happening right now is that they're maybe waiting for some people to either come off the board or for some decisions to be made that close off some avenues. And once that happens, then sort of their dominoes begin to fall.
Are Ben Revere and Michael Saunders bigger names than Jay Bruce?
No.
Okay.
No. Definitely not Revere. Saunders and Bruce are probably kind of,
I think Bruce is a bigger
on
name.
The level.
I guarantee you that someone with a longer name than Jay Bruce will be brought in.
There you go. Heard it here first.
I think the Blue Jays would like to bring in a bigger name than Jay Bruce. I think they're having trouble doing that this offseason because they've been very particular about their value on players and they have not wanted to move off of that. So I think they would have loved to bring in Dexter Fowler, but they just weren't going to move off of what their value was for him. And I think you can say the same for Encarnacion, the same for Bautista. I mean, I think that, you know, I think that this is front office right now that's very cognizant of the fact that you've got, you know, three more years of Troy Tulowitzki and Russell Martin at $20 million per year. That something's going to have to happen with Josh Donaldson at some point. Marcus Stroman is entering arbitration and, you know, Aaron Sanchez won't be too far behind him. I think it's a team that's very cognizant and very just wary of taking on a big financial commitment right now just to not handcuff themselves too much in the future. So yeah. I just don't think that they are willing to. Like, there's the great piece or the great quote in your piece from Andrew Friedman about if you want to be reasonable about every free agent, you're going to finish third.
Right.
So I just think that the Blue Jays would like to bring in a bigger name than Jay Bruce, but I don't think that I think they're just so stuck on their values right now that it kind of stops them from doing such a thing.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to bring in a bigger name than Jay Bruce. I think they might bring in someone who's
feel your Twitter mentions filling up right now with angst.
I could see them bringing in Jay Bruce. I mean, I don't see it. I don't see it. It would be
why
fun.
Not?
Because I think that I agree they did want Fowler, but then I mean, who's the name that's out there? I don't see them trading for Blackman. That would presumably cost a lot. Same goes for McCutchen. I don't know that there's a name that's out. I mean, I don't see them bringing back Edwin or Jose.
What if they got like someone like JD Martinez?
Yeah. I think that's a good idea. I think that he is probably a bigger name than Jay Bruce. And I think that's a good idea.
Would you not rather have Jose Bautista than JD Martinez? Because I think I would.
I think they're kind of similar. Right-handed power guys with limited to no defense.
But Bautista is much better at getting on base than JD is. Yeah. And he's been a better... He can handle right-handers better than Martinez has in his career, though JD had a good year against righties last year.
Yeah. JD had a great
younger.
Year last year.
Yeah.
Looking at right now.
Last 3 years, Martinez has been really good.
373 OBP last year, yeah, JD Martinez. Like, that's
last
just,
year was a great year, but
just
he only
below
played,
Bautista's
what,
level.
110-20?
120. 517 plate appearances. Hit 22 bombs.
And maybe this is the upswing. Like, maybe this is him moving into, what is he, 31?
Yeah, 29.
29. Maybe he's moving into his
peak.
Prime.
Yeah.
Right. So, but you're only getting him for 1 year, no?
Yep.
Yep.
So I would take him over Bautista, I think. I would take JD Martinez just for the age, you would assume some more durability. I know he broke his arm, but that's not a soft tissue injury.
Right, exactly.
And the year before he played 158 games.
Right. And didn't hit right handers particularly well at all. He slugged well, but he didn't get on base well. But yeah, and maybe that's it. And maybe it's Martinez plus the draft pick that you get for Bautista worth more than Bautista and what you have to give up to get Martinez.
Right.
And Martinez is $11.7 million for 2017.
Which is
for
perfect number for them.
For what he provides, yeah. And right. Yeah, he fits really nicely. Why'd you pull that name out of Shy? Jeez, where'd that come from?
And that way you get JD and Kendrys Morales for what you would have paid Edwin.
Right.
I think that would be great.
And look, I think a lot of these things are, there are a lot of dominoes to fall. And I think this is why the Blue Jays haven't gone to their secondary stuff yet. The reason that they rushed on Kendrys Morales was like they needed to, if they weren't going to have Edwin, they needed to get a quote unquote big bat for the middle of the lineup. They got their big bat and now they're in an area where there's a ton of surplus. And they can wait for whatever develops and try to find whatever they think is that they are most attracted to or the scenario that they like best to unfold. And so much is still to happen this offseason. It's remarkably saying this in late December.
Yeah.
But this offseason, this is like typically like maybe the middle of November now. if you're comparing it to your regular offseason.
And there's already been a lot of activity. Like Chris Sale was moved, Adam Eaton. You know, we've seen a lot of like the Morelands and Moraleses have come off the board. Like it's kind of gone backwards.
See, but there's still a home run champ out there in Chris Carter, right? Trumbo.
Both
Chris
two,
Carter.
Two,
yeah,
two
both of them home run champs, right? Yeah. Edwin's still out there. There's a lot of free agents that haven't gone anywhere yet.
And
a
there's,
lot of dominoes.
There's still trades too, because the Tigers want to dump. You know, the Oakland Athletics have to figure out what they're doing. You know, are the Angels really just going to go into the season the way they are right now? I mean, the White Sox still want to sell off more pieces.
Would you trade Pompey and Sean Reed Foley for Mike Trout?
only if the Angels threw something in.
Yeah. Can I get off the phone to laugh for
get
a second?
Get Cole Calhoun like, in there to sweeten it up and
yeah,
maybe I'll
that'll
do
that'll tip it for Shy for sure. Yeah.
All
right, our last question, and maybe a bit of a cruel one, and I'm glad that I don't have to be the first to answer this. Well, Shy is going to have to take this one on. You, Shy, you're the manager of the Toronto Blue Jays. You have to start one of the following outfielders for 130 games in 2017. Who do you choose? Melvin Upton Jr., Ezekiel Carrera, or Dalton Pompey?
Is resignation an option? No, I think if you're going to... this would depend on where the rest of the lineup is, but at some point you have to figure out what you have in Dalton Pompey, because Dalton Pompey is going to be out of options after the 2017 season, and you don't want to be guessing on him at that point. And so, if you're going to give him a real shot, and those are your only other two alternatives, this might be the time to give him that shot and see what you have in him.
I like that thought, and I like going with the young guys and like just seeing like so let's see what can happen. I don't know. I feel like Dalton Pompey still needs more seasoning and just more like he's really last year was the first year he had a full season at one level.
The which first was needed,
year,
right?
And that was needed, but it was almost an interrupted season because he kept having these injuries. Like he had a knee thing, and they had a heel thing, and they had a concussion, and like it was just so start and stop. And I know that was a very frustrating thing for him. I would probably go with Melvin Upton Jr. Just, a right-handed power bat is going to strike out a lot, but, you know, he can get on base better than Ezekiel Carrera can. Obviously, a much more proven commodity than Dalton Pompey. It gives you some speed. It can steal some bases for you. I don't know who's a better defender between Carrera and Upton. I don't know.
It's pretty clearly Upton.
Do you think Upton?
Despite the one game. Yeah. I think he's the best defender of the three, I would think.
Better than you think Upton's a better defender than Pompey?
I think Pompey's a little shaky, yeah.
Yeah. Upton can just fall asleep sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, like he can be a little spacey.
I think Upton plays all three spots the best of the three, but if you're going to go with someone in the corners, I think Pompey's probably reasonable.
If you're looking,
you can trust Pompey in the corner.
If Steve Pierce is an outfielder, then this is your right fielder that we're talking about because Pierce is not playing right.
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 Or at least shouldn't be.
Yeah. So yeah, I would go with Upton of those three.
Yeah, I agree. I just think that he's going to give you probably 20 home runs if he plays 130 games, and that might be all he gives you, at least compared to what you'd hope to get from a corner outfield spot. You're probably not going to get great defense or great on base, but at least you get to 20 homers. Whereas if you put Pompey out there, if you put Carrera out there, I'm not sure that there's any one thing that you really get from those guys, and that's a scary thought.
I think that everyone listening to this would have automatically said Carrera right off the top, and none of us have, going to continue. I know, but I mean, the way Ezekiel Carrera played in the playoffs and the way he played in September and in June when he filled in for Jose Bautista, look, I think Ezekiel Carrera can give you a great 3 weeks, and that's terrific for a fourth outfielder, but I don't want him in the lineup for 120 games. And if Justin Smoke is playing a lot of first base, I don't want Melvin Upton Jr. in the lineup because I don't want 500 strikeouts in my 7 and 8 spots. I think Melvin, like you said, Arden, he's a proven commodity, but in 3 of the last 4 years, I think he's proven to be awful. He was terrible in Atlanta, and he was a train wreck with the Jays last year over the last 2 months after being fined in San Diego. Upton as a bat against lefties, as a pair of legs off the bench. But for me, it's Pompey.
You left for Pompey?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For me, like Shy said, you got to see. But as well, I mean, you're talking about a 9-hitter, potentially. Switch hitter, athletic, teaching a bunt his way on maybe a little bit. But he's got on base skills. that he's shown in the minor leagues. I'm just as fine with having Dalton Pompey hit ninth for me as I am with having Ben Revere hit ninth for me.
My go-to line on Ezekiel Carrera used to be, he's perfect in the spot that he's in. Fourth outfielder, plays sparingly. You don't want more exposure to him. Mm-hmm. But then he did get more exposure last year.
And was awful.
And well, look at
what happened the first time Jose Bautista was hurt. He was great for 3 weeks. And then in July, he hit a wall and he hit about 100 for a month. And then in the playoffs, he was good. But in the playoffs, they played, 11 games in 22 days or something like that. So if you can get that in your schedule, then Zeke is great.
Was part of the portion when he hit 100. I think his OPS during that time was 324 or something. Was part of that the Achilles injury that put him on the DL? And
pretty terrible going into it, though, too.
You know, that's just a devil's advocate point. But I remember an executive once said to me, the problem with part-time players is when you start giving them full-time at-bats, they quickly remind you why they're part-time players. And you know, I don't know that we can necessarily say that the die is definitively cast on Ezekiel Carrera, but I think at this point, it's you can reasonably assume that he sort of is what he is. I don't know that there's a ton more there that you could possibly expect from him.
One wonders if that might happen with Steve Pierce too, which is why they're really not talking about him being a full-time guy, I don't think, but he's never been a full-time player.
Right.
That's mostly injuries in his career. I mean, he's been on the DL 10 times.
Yeah, he's been hurt a lot.
Yeah.
But it took people a while to notice that he could hit too. And I think he's going to play first against every lefty, and maybe sparingly against some righties. But if he's forced into, you know, if Justin Smoke has the same year again and Pierce is forced into a lot of work, maybe there's a down tick there too.
Does something have to give in the outfield? Because I think we all probably expect him to bring at least one more outfielder, preferably two. And you've already got Pilar, Upton Jr., Carrera, Pierce, Pompey. Then you're going to add one or two names to that. Does something have to give there?
I think that you could option Pompey, have Zeke as your fourth outfielder. Yeah, you'd have to consider Pierce to be one of your backup infielders at that point, right? Well, otherwise, you start running out of bench spots.
My guess is that they're going to bring in at least either one everyday outfielder or possibly two part-time outfielders, right? And
if you have to swallow Upton, you know, you're only paying him,
$1 million.
$1 million bucks.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that big a deal.
Right. Carrera's first year ARB. And I think that at this point, you probably want to keep Carrera. But I think that if you bring in one more everyday guy, they've got Pilar and... Pilar and to be named, plus some combination of Pierce, Carrera, Upton, and knowing that Pierce is going to get some time in the infield for you as well, and potentially occasional DH day if Morales needs some time off.
I think the if Pierce is an actual everyday guy, his ideal use is first base against lefties, left field against righties.
Right.
And you can put Upton in left field against lefties, and Guy plays right.
Makes sense.
That makes sense. Yeah, that would work. Is Steve Pierce an everyday guy?
We don't know.
If he can stay on the field.
Yeah.
If he can stay on the field, do you think he ends up playing more games than not?
Yeah.
Yes. Sure. If he's healthy, I believe the Blue Jays feel that if he can stay on the field for every day, that he's done enough at the plate over the course of his career that it justifies playing every day, and that he can hit both lefties and righties, although he destroys lefties, that he can be very good against righties as well.
And he has been in the past. And I think this year, too, the Blue Jays are far less reluctant if somebody goes down and they need an outfield replacement to bring up Pompey and have him play.
Right. You're going to want to protect Pierce a bit against the injuries, too. Like, you're going to want to give him days off here and there. And it's going to be challenging with Kendrys Morales basically having to play DH every day.
Just if Zeke is here, he can play twice a week.
Yeah.
Right?
The one thing that's going to be interesting to watch is, where is Pierce with his throwing? Because he came off the surgery for the elbow issues last September. And if he is playing him in the outfield too much, going to irritate that elbow or cause some more trouble. So maybe physically he might be limited from playing a ton in the outfield.
Right, and even before the surgery, he wasn't a right field. He didn't have a right fielder's arm.
Right.
So he's going to be in left or at first.
Exciting storylines going into the 2017 season. Plenty still to come, though. The offseason is incomplete. As Shai said, it's moving slowly. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming here today. Any final thoughts before we let you go about the year that was? Any holiday greetings?
It was a lovely year. I think that you know, we see a lot of each other over the course of the year and over the course of the season and in spring training. And you know, we have a good crew of people, and it makes the job that much easier when you're hanging out with people that you enjoy and that you can have good discussion with about baseball or whatever else. And so thank you three for a good 2016. And here's to more and better in 2017. Oh, maybe more days off for you guys.
Well put.
Because you've earned it.
That's so nice, Mike. It's so unlike you.
As the elder statesman, I had to say something nice.
I will say that my great disappointment is that our car podcast was not of broadcast quality to make the air during spring training, and that perhaps next spring we can leap the technological hurdles that we faced and come up with some sort of creative podcast on a road trip somewhere.
I was pushing to have it put up. Sam was like, no, I cannot do this.
It was a hard no.
Sam
it
was not like, even, I yeah. will get fired there if was I no put this on the air. We can't have that.
Yeah.
People needed to hear us going through that toll booth. I think that would have been, but it was a lot of fun this season, and we had lots of interesting stories to talk about, and obviously a tremendous team to be a part of with you guys. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, Ben. And thanks to everyone for listening too. So it's much appreciated, and we will have many more episodes.
Yes,
possibly soon. If they make some moves, we'll have more of these soon.
Absolutely. No, that was my shout out. Thank you to you, the people, for listening. We had a tremendous numbers week last week in like ratings, like listens wise, in a week where the Blue Jays did nothing, in a week where people should really have better things to do. So the we do take for granted sometimes, I think, just how fervent this fan base is,
yeah,
and how into the Blue Jays, like how large and passionate they are. And while that can sometimes have, you know, poor consequences in your Twitter mentions, I think that for the most part, you know, 8 to 9 out of 10 fans are just, you know, good, passionate Blue Jays fans who just want to, you know, be engaged and have intelligent discussions about the team.
Well, if you love baseball, it's impossible not to appreciate the way fans across the country, not only particularly in the city, but across the country as well, become engaged. And obviously it's a great time period to be a Blue Jays fan, to be covering the team because of the interest. And it'll be interesting to see what the reaction is to what plays out in the next couple of years.
I think we're seeing the reaction.
Yeah. But you know what? We saw the same thing last year,
yeah.
Right? Last year when Jay Happ signed and David Price didn't, everyone was equally angry as they are right now. But I think we do take for granted a little bit the enormity of this fan base and the passion of it. You know, it's tough to see the forest for the trees when you're right in the middle of it all the time, like the four of us are. But it is pretty phenomenal that the Blue Jays have the following that they do. And yeah, absolutely, that a lot of that spills over onto us. It's a wonderful thing.
Well,
so thank you out there.
You only hear from the miscreants, right? Like, you know,
people who are happy don't call in on the postgame show very often.
Right? Yeah. It's the same.
Why would they?
On Twitter, it's the same 20 people who are just upset about everything, right? But like, I think that the vast majority of fans are actually like, they understand what the team's doing and what's happening. And they're happy to, you know, just have insightful discussions about it.
It's funny that last year, with all the anger that we see on Twitter and that I, you know, that I hear from people, I was thinking going into the season, well, are people still going to show up for this team?
Yeah.
You know, and then it was overwhelming, and it reminded me, oh, there are a lot of people out there that don't interact on Twitter and that aren't upset, that love this team and are really excited. And I think that continues.
They had led the AL in attendance. Yep. No? Yeah. Yep. That's substantial. Yep. That is like, this is a massive, massive fan base. And that's just the people who can get to games.
Yeah.
There's so many Blue Jays fans out there who can't get to games. When you're going on the road and you're playing before home crowds in Seattle and in Minneapolis and places like this, that's special.
But the Blue Jay fans, I would think that, you know, maybe aside from, you know, Yankees, Red Sox, Cardinals, I think the Blue Jays are on par or pretty close to those fan bases in terms of traveling to see the team, because they are in every city, you know. And I think that the Blue Jays are fortunate because, and I was actually talking to someone from Major League Baseball about this, his estimate was that the Blue Jays fan base is probably 10 to 15 years younger on average than that of your typical Major League team It is a young fan base. It's a moneyed fan base. It's one that wants to spend money on experiences, which is very valuable. These people care, are invested emotionally and financially. So, I mean, the Blue Jays are in a really good spot with that, and they've got to be careful that they don't lose it.
That's a good place to end right there. Wow, that is pretty perfect from Shai Davidi. And if you need a last minute Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever gift, might I recommend The Big 50 by Shai Davidi? The inside story of I forget what the tagline is on it, but like, it's a great book. Go buy it. It's by Shai Davidi, The Big 50. There's a big Blue Jays hat on it. Follow Shai on Twitter at Shai Davidi. Our thanks to Mike Wilderness, who you probably already follow on Twitter at Wilderness590. Thanks for coming in. We're looking forward to hearing you more on the radio next year.
Thank you. We're looking forward to Shai's new business venture, the Thai Davidi, the restaurant.
Yes.
The restaurant chain.
Oh, man. It's going to be a hit. I can tell. I'll be the first client through those doors.
And Ben Nixon-Smith at BNixon-Smith on Twitter. Our producer, Sam McKee at Sam A. McKee on Twitter. Thank you to him for putting up with us all year. My name's Arden Zwelling. Thanks for listening. Have a safe and happy holidays from all of us here at The Letters.